Hello, I'm Chris Miller. I'm going to talk about some cluster work that's being done in the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. There are a number of people looking for clusters in the SDSS. You may not have seen a lot of papers come out yet, but there have been a few that have been coming out. I'm going to talk about a few today. I'm going to talk about Jim Annis's cluster catalog, which uses a lot of color information. Talk about that in a second. Rita Kim has put together a match filter algorithm and also a Voronoi tessellation algorithm on the early data release, and that I think is in press. Tomo Goto at CMU put together something he calls cut and enhance, which takes color and spatial information in a clever way, and he's published his catalog, so that's available to the public. Ryoichi Kuwasawa is a graduate student at Pitt, and I'm not sure if he's finishing up his or not, but he took match filter and applied PhotoZs and another method to do it. Andreas Berlin is working with groups. I'm going to talk about my catalog, which uses mostly color space, and Brian Lee at Fermilab developed the group finder. So just to get the point across that there are going to be, in the very near future, a flood of cluster catalogs coming out of the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, just to keep an eye out for. So then I had to think about, as I've been working on my cluster finder, I wanted to remind myself why I'm doing this, because it's hard. When you get more data and you get better data, it actually doesn't get easier to find clusters because you can do so many more things. So it actually gets rather challenging. So the idea of tracing large-scale structure is one of the more obvious ones. This plot here is a power spectrum plot of a couple of different surveys. Oh, this thing working. It killed the batteries on me. I have to twist it. Thanks. Okay. I got it. Oh, no, good. So these are two cluster surveys up here and two galaxy surveys, and all of the power spectra have been shifted by some sort of relative bias to match each other at a wave number of about 0.05. And the point here is that clusters, which are the black circles and red stars, these are old cluster surveys, but they still do a very fine job of tracing the global shape of the power spectrum over a wide range of scales. This is something like 600 H inverse megaparsecs all the way down to 50 H inverse megaparsecs. And if you include window functions in this, you'd find that these power spectra are all basically identical over this range of scales. So clusters do get your information on the power spectra, and this bias continues above red galaxies all the way up to clusters. I stole this plot from Max's talk. I really like this plot. And one thing that kind of struck out, what this plot is, this is the power spectrum as a function of wave number for a bunch of different tracers. The black squares are the cosmic microwave background. You have the 2DF galaxy survey, you have Lyman Alpha Faris on there, all this information, all this wonderful information. But the only survey right now that actually traces over the peak of the power spectrum is from the CMB. So our surveys are not large enough right now to trace over the peak of the power spectrum. The only information we have is from the CMB. And working in large scale structure, I used to say that we've never seen the peak in the power spectrum, but I guess we actually have. It's just been in the CMB. And I'm glad Max put this plot up to show me that. Cluster abundance, I won't talk anything about, actually, but Elena Pierpaoli talked about this earlier in the week, but there's people in the Sloan that are working on sigma 8 from clusters, and this is a very interesting topic to be working on. Galaxy formation and evolution. All galaxies live in some sort of clustered environment, basically, and that environment has an effect on the formation and evolution of those galaxies in those environments. So I can put up this plot. This is a work we did with some clusters from the early data release, and what this is, this is the star formation rate of galaxies. The median star formation rate is this black line here as a function of distance from the center of the nearest cluster. And you can see that as you move into a cluster center, the star formation rate drops off. This is the 75th percentile of star formation rates. So these are galaxies with high star formation rates. And you can see as they hit about 3 VR radii or so, the star formation rate really drops off pretty quickly as you get down to the center of a cluster. So obviously we can get a lot of information here about galaxy formation and evolution and their effective environment on the galaxy star formation rates. But another thing this plot tells me is that galaxy clusters are big. This is 3 or 4 VR radii out here. So I stopped thinking about clusters. I used to think about clusters in terms of their Abel radius out to a megaparsec and a half, but really the effect of a cluster is, you know, 5-6 megaparsecs in most cases, H inverse megaparsecs. Something to keep in mind. We also have scaling laws. Clusters are useful to look at these. We know these scaling laws exist, and we want to be doing these sorts of things in the simulations. So these are some hydrodynamic simulations from Davi, Katz, and Weinberg recently that came out. And these are scaling laws. So on the x-axis on this side is the velocity dispersion of a cluster. And here we've got x-ray luminosity, and you can see the scaling law go up. You can see there's a break at some velocity dispersion as you go down into the group regime. And determining where this break is actually going to be pretty important in the observational data. It'll give us information onto entropy, preheating, things like that in clusters. The temperature sigma scaling law is actually a very tight one. And these things are now becoming easy to do in the simulations. At least they're doable in the simulation. So we need to be hammering these out as well in the observational data. We don't have good plots like these for the observational data yet. Cluster evolution, in the sense that have clusters evolved in terms of their luminosity, in terms of their temperature, not just their number density as a function of redshift, but there's a lot of interesting stuff we'll be able to do with higher redshift clusters. And this means in the Sloan that we're going to be using the photometric survey quite a bit to do that sort of thing. Multi-wavelength targets. I throw up here a plot from the ACBAR team. This is on the Viper telescope. This is an ABEL cluster. The colors are the CMB, and you also have X-ray in the whites, and you have the radio lobes in the black. So just as targets for interesting multi-wavelength studies, clusters are always going to be useful for these sorts of things. And then there's Hale occupation, which Chris Kachanek talked a little bit about on Tuesday. So in the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, we have colors. Five bands, four colors we can use. So instead of just using the matched filter algorithms, which typically just count, basically they're just a fancy counting algorithm, we can actually really use this color information in a way we haven't before. So I'm going to talk first about Jim Annis's maximum likelihood brightest cluster galaxy technique, MAX-BCG, in case you haven't seen this before. This should be coming out. We hope to have a catalog or an algorithm paper out in a couple of months. But what he can do is he can sit on every cluster that he knows is already there. He can find the brightest galaxy in that cluster, and then he can make these diagnostic plots. And this is magnitude as a function of redshift, color as a function of redshift, color versus color with a redshift track, another color versus color with a redshift track. And then what he can do once he has these diagnostics for all of these brightest cluster galaxies, he can say, he can sit on every galaxy in the SDSS that he wants to, and he can say, what's the probability I look like a BCG in magnitude, in color, in color? Okay, so he can actually assign a probability every galaxy that he's sitting on whether or not he's a brightest cluster galaxy. One of the important pieces that he uses is the color-magnitude relation. This is color, this is magnitude, and he puts down a box on every galaxy he's sitting at, and he counts up all the galaxies that fit within that color-magnitude relationship box. And that's a very important piece of Jim's cluster finder. And as he moves, this dotted line is as he tracks out in redshift, this box will move and change in size. That allows Jim to find clusters very well. And we've tested this on simulations, and it's a pretty good cluster finder. But it's really significantly different from the standard cluster finders like Match Filter. And it uses really a lot of color information. One that I've been working on is a non-parametric clustering technique in a seven-dimensional space. And very simply, what I do is I sit on every galaxy, and I lay down a seven-dimensional box. Three positions, four colors, and I make a count. I say how many galaxies have the same colors as the galaxies I'm sitting at. They also have to have the same position. If that count is 50, that doesn't mean anything to me. But if I now take that box and I throw it on 100 random locations, and I build up a distribution of counts, I can decide whether or not 50 galaxies in that box is important or not, is clustered or not. So I do this for the whole Sloan sample, and I determine whether or not galaxies sit in clustered environments in this seven-dimensional space. Here's the idea. The galaxy here is sitting in a certain color. This is the color of the galaxy I'm looking at. This box is defined by a couple of things, including the error on the color on that galaxy. These are all the other galaxies around this galaxy that are nearby, but only one, this red one, actually fits in this box in all seven dimensions in this case. If I take that box and move to where I know there's a cluster, and I lay that box down, I'll actually count up like 10 or 12 galaxies that sit within that seven-dimensional space. This would be a cluster-like galaxy. This wouldn't. If I do this in the spectroscopic survey, I can do all kinds of good tests. I can make sure I've really got a cluster. There's a velocity histogram of a cluster I'm sitting on. Anything green in here is what I would call a C4 galaxy, and then I have spectra for anything that's red or blue in here. This is the cluster I'm sitting on. These would also be clusters too. I'm just not focusing on them in these plots. If I make a color magnitude plot of color versus magnitude here, you can see that I really probe down really deeply into the field here in terms of the color magnitude relation. That's great with spectra, and of course you can do velocity dispersion as well. But making this work in the photometric data is just as important. This plot here I took from Kadama et al. a recent paper he put out. They went out and got a night of observing time on the Subaru 8-meter, got a very high signal-to-noise, 5-band or 6-band colors for these galaxies, and created pretty accurate photo-Zs. Now, the photo-Zs in the Sloan are going to be reasonably accurate, and they're going to be great for large-scale structure, but they're not going to be good enough to actually find clusters. They're just not that tight. But if you get really high signal-to-noise, you can actually get very good photo-Zs, and every galaxy in this box is about 10 megaparsecs across, is at the redshift of this very rich cluster. And you can see that he's traced, and he does this all with photo-Zs, and he has all these satellite groups. These aren't background or foreground, these are at the redshift of this cluster. Of course, it took a night of observing time on an 8-meter. Now, we can't do it at 0.4, but at 0.14, we can do a similar thing with the clustering, with the C4 algorithm, this color clustering technique. Any dot in here is a galaxy that's determined to be in this cluster using just its color information. These aren't photo-Zs, right? They're significantly different than photo-Zs, but we decide that they're in this thing right here, this cluster right here. And anything with a color here is a spectrally confirmed galaxy. So these satellites out here that we detect in the C4 clustering algorithm are spectroscopically confirmed, okay? And you can also, anything blue in here is low star formation rate. Anything green, which are spread out throughout the field, are high star formation rate. And that's determined through the H-alpha equivalent width line. You want to make sure this thing's working, so you do it in simulations, but simulations are just now coming online that give us good colors. And these positions and galaxies have been out for years in simulations, but actually assigning good colors that map, that trace the large-scale structure and actually give you right luminosity functions and two-point functions as a function of magnitude and density and things like that we're working on these right now. So this is the Virgo simulation. Any black dot in here is a C4 cluster galaxy. And a red square means that it's found in the Halo catalog for the Virgo simulation. A blue circle means it's found as a cluster in the C4, in the clustering C4 algorithm. So the idea here is that you want to make sure your clustering algorithm traces what you see in the simulations, and you can sort of tune your algorithm according to what you expect from the simulations. Of course, this means that you need simulations that give you nice colors and things like that, which we're just now getting. Now, I wanted to show you a few scaling laws as I end up my talk here on these clusters. On the left-hand side, this is a plot of luminosity, optical luminosity. It's sort of a tracer of richness. I think it's a little more informative than richness because it's not just a count, and it has some meaning to it. But richnesses are being redefined to be actually a little more meaningful. But on the left-hand side, I have luminosity as a function of velocity dispersion for clusters. This is in the Virgo simulation, so all these are from the Virgo simulations. These are total optical luminosities, these are Z-band, and these are R-band luminosities. And then in the real data, I have a very similar mapping. And in fact, the scatter isn't significantly different between these two. So the scatter that I see here is probably, maybe not intrinsic, but certainly it means that in terms of the algorithm we have right now, that's maybe the best we can do on a lot of these scaling laws. Some look better than others. This is sort of cheating. This is virial mass as a function of velocity dispersion, but of course I use velocity dispersion to get the virial mass. The red triangles in here are CNOT clusters. You can see that in the Virgo simulations over here, these are the big massive systems. In the small area of the Sloan early data release, we just don't have a lot of big massive systems yet. We need lots of area for that. So it's more reasons for large area coverage, not just tracing the peak in the power spectrum, but getting this nice big massive clusters. You can do mass to light. You can do scaling relationships for anything you want to measure, anything you can come up with in this data. And that's one of the beauties of the Sloan data, is you can do this on a homogeneous fashion. I can actually even do extra luminosities, and I don't have to go to the literature to get these because the Rose et al. Sky Survey has been released. So I can actually, for the brighter clusters anyway, I can actually go out and get and measure my own extra luminosities and make sure I've done it in the exact same way that I'm measuring something like a velocity dispersion, using the same radius, the same profile, everything that's included in doing that. So what I show here, the circles are clusters in the EDR. All these dots are from a compilation in the literature, the Mahdavi and Geller compilation. We've actually reduced the scatter on this LX versus sigma V relationship by about a factor of 2 or 3 right now. We've really just taken a first cut at the data, and I think we're going to be able to do even better as we move on and we eliminate clusters with lots of substructure and things like that that make measuring velocity dispersions hard. So let me wrap up. I think finding clusters is still important. Someone's certainly going to be doing it. So the ABOL catalog and the APN catalog and all these cluster catalogs that have been around for years, I think they worked well, and they And Chris Kachanik, I think, called them ruddy. I wouldn't quite call them ruddy. Even like the projection effects in the ABLE catalog is a pretty small number, like 10%. The problem is you don't know your selection function, right? Because he sat down, had two cups of coffee one night and six the other, and you found more clusters the second night. You're never going to put that in your selection function. You really need your selection function to do most of these things accurately. That's why you need a well-defined algorithm that's repeatable and testable. So I don't think there's anything wrong with those catalogs, but you can only believe them to a certain degree because of these selection function effects. And the photometry in the SDSS, this five-band stuff, it really allows us to look for clusters in very new and ingenious ways. And match filter is a great algorithm. It's worked for over a decade on very well on many data sets. But that's not the only way to find clusters. And it's something to keep in mind when these cluster catalogs start coming out and you want to start using them. If you want to be studying the red sequence, say as a function of redshift, you don't want to be picking a cluster catalog that was measured and required to have a red sequence, right? You want to use something else. Maybe a match filter would work well for that, right? So when these cluster catalogs come out, it's important, and hopefully this will be very clear in all of the papers, that the clusters catalogs, these algorithms, they find what they're looking for. And it's very important that when you apply these cluster catalogs and the data in them to your techniques, you keep in mind exactly what they were looking for. And also, with the idea of simulations, you know, the N-body community is doing wonders right now, and getting accurate colors and star formation rates and things like that into the simulations is just going to be a wonder in the next couple of years. And I think the Sloan is helping push that along because we really need these things right now. And that's all I wanted to say about clusters. So right now, in the Virgo simulations, the magnitude, the galaxies and their magnitudes are assigned according to the luminosity dependence of the two-point function. Then once we have the magnitude, the galaxies in with their magnitudes, now it just doesn't match the luminosity function, it matches the clustering dependence on the luminosity function. Once we have that, then we go in and we draw data from the real Sloan Digital Sky Survey with a certain density, and we measure density by its 10th nearest neighbor. We find a galaxy in the Virgo simulations that has the same 10th nearest neighbor density, and we assign colors in that way. So we pull the colors directly out of the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, the distribution from the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. So right now it's an empirical technique just to test an algorithm. But there are groups, Max Planck, that are working on doing this a little more from a semi-analytic point of view, and that's going to be just as interesting, if not more so.
Is there a physical reason, obvious reason, like star formation is so low in the middle of the galaxy?
Well, that's the sort of the question that we're trying to answer. Is it Ram pressure stripping as these galaxies fall into the center of the cluster? Are they losing all their gas? There's a lot of questions there that we're going to try and answer. There's a lot of different answers for it, but I don't have a preferred favorite one yet. Right, so it's an...
Did you hear that?
Should I repeat that? The question was, why do we expect galaxies to have the same color? Well, we know something like the color magnitude relation exists. We've seen that in clusters. But just putting that aside for a moment, the idea is we have information, we have these colors and magnitudes, positions, and redshifts. We're just clustering in some high-dimensional space, right? So we're finding clusters that are clustered in this high-dimensional space. It just so happens that four of our dimensions are color. So in the end, we find clusters that have galaxies that have similar colors to them. That's just what we find. It doesn't mean that there are clusters out there that might have just a random distribution of colors. And that will get a lot of information, interesting information, out of clustering if we can actually find these systems.
I have a question about the selection of the galaxies for spectra. Are you using some of the information about galaxy clustering to concentrate on areas where you might want to get the internal properties of a cluster from a lot of spectra, or is that just too hard?
In terms of how the Sloan target selects? So the Sloan has a targeting, the Sloan has
it's
really too hard. They'll
okay, then can I ask another
question? Okay, sure.
Short enough. We heard a lot earlier in the week about looking for clusters in an unbiased way with Sinyata's elderly techniques. What's the overlap between the zones that people are choosing for those catalogs in this region?
Most of the ESZ, well, the ones that I know of are on in the South Pole, so there's not a lot of overlap there.
That was the thing, it was a little puzzling.
Yeah. But we will have Planck. We just have to wait for it.
Well, we've been just during this conference, the Apex has been sitting able to talk with Josh and others about possible overlaps. We're going to be observing from Atacama Plateau in Chile, which is in a moderate southern latitude where we can't overlap like the equatorial strip of Sulawesi. So there's a possibility of overlap there.
Yeah. The multi-wavelength thing is a good question, and you know, we don't have an X-ray telescope right now that's observing these clusters either. If you want them, you have to go out for them one by one. So, we're really kind of hurting for the multi-wavelength information.
The South Pole, this very ambitious program in the South Pole is going to need something like this.
So there are comparisons. Since there are all these cluster catalogs, there's a project going on to compare them between the two. And in the ideal world, we would have one cluster catalog, and it would have all the information. But the reality is there are multiple ways to find clusters. And as I said, your algorithm finds what you look for. And none of these cluster catalogs, no matter what they claim, none of these catalogs are 100% complete. They're 100% complete for what they're looking for. So if you have two catalogs that are 70% complete and you compare them, you know, you should be happy if you get a 50% match rate. So if you know, it's going to be difficult. There's talk now of putting together maybe a superset of clusters that are matched between all. And there'll be something interesting that comes out of that. Now determining the selection function for that's going to be pretty hard because there's seven different selection functions, but we'll be working on that. But if you know your selection function, if you really think you know your selection function, the mismatches, missing a few clusters is never a problem. You just account for that. And there will be mismatches. It's not a big deal. It's expected. You completely expect this to happen. So, yeah. You hope that in the massive end you've got everything. But if you don't, then you have to worry about what your algorithm's doing. But you'll see papers about that in a couple of months, I think.
Maybe we can continue discussion over lunch. So let's thank Chris.